From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, how scientists discovered that the brain is the center of thought and intelligence. We talk with science writer Carl Zimmer. His book is called Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. Also, Wedding Crashers, the new movie about a couple of guys who go to the weddings of complete strangers just to meet women. We'll talk with Wedding Crashers co-star Vince Vaughn, and David Edelstein has a review of the film. And how the war on terror has affected the cultural landscape. Critic John Powers tells us how two summer blockbusters reflect America's fear of terrorism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, in for Terry Gross. We're going to look back to the time when scientists were just discovering the function of the brain through very primitive experimental brain surgery. Carl Zimmer is the author of the book Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. It's just out in paperback. It focuses on the work of Thomas Willis, one of the fathers of neurology, who began his surgical investigations into the brain in 1662. This was a time when many scientists were also alchemists, a time when many scientists believed that the soul was located in the liver and heart, a time when a scientist could be put to death if his work challenged the teachings of the church. Carl Zimmer spoke with Terry Gross early last year. In the mid-1600s, when Willis was beginning his research, scientists believed that the heart was the center of thought, perception, and action. Scientists didn't yet know about the existence of nerves and didn't understand the importance of the brain.
The brain as we think of it, the brain as this 3 pounds of flesh, the brain that we know as being billions of neurons that are trading signals and chemicals, no one knew the brain as being such a thing. The funny thing is that the one thing in the head that they were struck by were these little holes in the brain. If you were to cut off the top of someone's head and look in their head, you would see a few kind of squiggly little recesses right at the core of the brain. And so people started imagining that these must be very important, that they were what were called ventricles. And they had this idea that in life they were expanded to be these beautiful vaulted spheres and that spirits would rush through them. And these were spirits that you would actually breathe in from the air. In a sense, you were sort of breathing in part of the world's soul, and it became the spirits that would flow through your body. And they would go through these chambers, these ventricles, and then on their way into the rest of the body. But the brain itself, no one cared about.
Your book focuses on the research of Thomas Willis, who was a scientist in the 1600s, and who you consider the father, I guess people in the field consider him the father of neurology. When he started to investigate the brain, what was the current theory at the time of intelligence and perception?
You can get some interesting insights into what people thought about the mind and intelligence and the brain and so on by looking at contemporary sources like Shakespeare, for example. Or if you look at the journals of 17th century doctors, you get some interesting ideas. So intelligence really wasn't a factor then. I mean, people didn't talk about IQ. They didn't really even talk about idiocy versus intelligence. It just wasn't sort of on their radar. They saw people as being these combinations of humors, these strange substances like black bile and yellow bile, choler, phlegm. And when these got out of balance, they would alter a person's temperament. So we think of personality as being this thing that is the product of our brains and the way that our brains work and the way that the neurons are exchanging chemicals. No one had any sort of concept like this. So Thomas Willis was steeped in all these sorts of ideas. I mean, and so as a young doctor, he would try to apply them. He would try to apply the ideas of ancient doctors like Galen, for example, because that's what he had been taught. But there were just a lot of other ideas kind of roaming around at the time that were challenging this conventional wisdom, so that he began to wonder, for example, if I am treating an hysterical woman, a woman with hysteria, is it really the case that her womb is rising up in her belly, which is what Galen and everyone else believed? Or is there some other explanation that I should be looking for?
Thomas Willis was part alchemist and part physician. What did it mean to be an alchemist in the 1600s?
Well, alchemists were not really the sort of stereotype we have of them today as being from the bad old days before real science got started. They were investigating nature. They were doing experiments. They were trying to understand what matter was made of. And there was actually a long tradition of using alchemy for medicine, so trying to figure out how to create drugs that could transform the body in the same way the Philosopher's Stone was supposed to transform lead into gold. And so this was not something that Thomas Willis would learn in his lectures at Oxford. They were being taught the conventional wisdom from Galen and Aristotle and the other Greeks. But on the side, he was working for a woman who was a sort of a home doctor of sorts, and he was having to make these medicines based on alchemy. And so that got him interested in the whole concept, which helped to make him think about the body not as the four humors, whatever that means, but as sort of a place where chemical reactions took place. And so he wanted to know what were the chemicals that made up the body. Ultimately, his question became, what are the chemicals that make up the brain?
He performed a lot of surgery on corpses to remove and study the brain. What are some of the things that struck him most when he first saw a whole brain?
He was very impressed by it as a very elegant device. People were starting to think of the body as a machine, but no one really thought of the brain as a machine because it tended to look like just a lot of mush. But with his methods, he was able to appreciate just how intricately put together it is, how many different parts it actually has, how the blood vessels creep around to every little nook and cranny in the brain. He called it a curious quilted ball. And he also realized that these ventricles that had dominated our understanding of the anatomy of the head and were supposed to be where these spirits were, that had dominated our thinking for 1,000 years or more, that they were just empty holes, that they had nothing to do with the business of the soul.
Now, he also did a lot of experiments on animals, dogs, for instance. What are some of the experiments he did on the brains of dogs?
One of the great ideas that Thomas Willis had was that different parts of the brain are responsible for different functions of the body, that you could actually look at a part of the brain and say, this is responsible for doing one thing, this is responsible for doing another thing over here. This is really where all modern neuroscience comes from, trying to parcel up the brain and figuring out its anatomy to figure out what it does. And so he was the first person to really talk about that, but he had to prove it. One of the things that he did was he did an experiment on a dog to show that one part of the brain near the base was responsible for kind of our involuntary functions, like the beating of our heart or the breathing of our lungs, whereas our voluntary motions and our thoughts were going on elsewhere. So what he did, and this is quite a grisly experiment, he would open up a dog's skull, he would damage part of the brain near the base, and then stitch the dog up and see what happened. Well, the dog suffered a pretty horrible death. Fortunately, not all of his experiments were quite as gruesome. He was able, for example, to show that there was this elegant network of blood vessels that supplied the brain with blood, and that you could, even if you cut off one artery going to the head, the others could compensate. And so he did this with a dog, and the dog, he reported afterwards, would follow him around the town as he went to visit his patients, was perfectly happy. And this was further proof to him that the brain was this wonderfully constructed device that had this essential supply of blood given to it in order to work.
Before Thomas Willis, the popular theories were that spirits or the humors affected, you know, intelligence and emotion. Did Willis end up believing that there was still some role for spirits in the body?
Thomas Willis kept on talking about spirits, but what he was talking about when he said spirits was something very different from what came even a century before. In the Renaissance, people believed that there were lots of different spirits in the body. There were vital spirits coming out of the heart and other spirits coming out of the liver. They're responsible for your desires and your appetites, and the animal spirits that were in these ventricles. Not only that, but there were souls in everything around us. There were souls in plants and in the sky, and there were spirits moving around, sort of enacting their will. And what Thomas Willis did was he took all those ideas and made them mechanical, made them chemical. He said, yes, there are spirits, but all they are special kind of corpuscles, he called them. You could think of them as molecules or atoms or some sort of information-bearing thing. And in this way, he was really part of the scientific revolution, which was trying to take these mystical souls out of nature.
The soul was really the province of the church. How did his research and his theories affect the religious teachings of his time?
Well, what happened was that the church started backing away from insanity in a sense that it was no longer considered a matter for the church. The church would often accuse, for example, Quakers of being fanatics, of you know, just being nuts. And, you know, they were, the Quakers at the time were doing some pretty radical things, like walking around naked in the streets to jolt people out of their complacency. But after Thomas Willis started sort of explaining human nature according to the brain, the church started to say, well, these people just must have, you know, disordered brains, and we just need to send them to the doctors. And so this was a real fundamental shift that occurred. And remarkably, the church that had been so disturbed by the implications of the scientific revolution through Thomas Willis ended up embracing one of the central parts of it.
Were there things that the church had seen as demonic possession that it started to see as a disorder of the brain?
Yes, absolutely. Epilepsy, for example, had for centuries been considered a sign of possession. Nightmares had as well. How else to explain how someone could close their eyes and feel that they were being transported to some distant place? Or how could you explain how someone would start raving and screaming and foaming at the mouth? There must be demons. Thomas Willis looked very carefully at these explanations, and he said, I don't think so. And he used his new kind of neurology to say epilepsy is really just a chemical imbalance. It's the explosions that normally happen in a very orderly way in the body getting out of control, so that you're having sort of a kind of a wildfire of the mind, as it were. And so the church would back away from these sort of disorders, saying, okay, well, these too are the province of medicine. They're not for the church anymore.
When did Willis's ideas about the brain start to catch on?
Surprisingly, they caught on really fast. A lot of scientists have had to suffer for years in obscurity before they really grab the attention of their society. But Thomas Willis's first book about the brain, it's called The Anatomy of the Brain, came out in 1664, and it was an immediate hit. It went through four editions in the first year. I think it went through about 20 editions all told. It was being published well into the 1800s. And his illustrations, which were done by Christopher Wren, you could still see in textbooks in the 20th century. So these ideas took hold immediately. Not just his ideas about how the brain was structured or how the brain worked, but his ideas about the soul and about diseases of the soul and of the brain. It's probably a sign of how ready society was for an explanation like his. The scientific revolution had been going on for quite a while at that point, and people were starting to be able to accept these ideas. And so he just came along at the right time and was smart enough to put all these things together.
When Thomas Willis died, did he donate his own brain to science?
There's no record of that.
I just really wonder if he would have wanted his skull cut open and investigated after death.
I'm sure he would have been happy for someone to look at his brain.
He probably would have wanted to do it himself. I bet he was.
He would have loved to have known what it looked like.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Carl Zimmer speaking with Terry Gross in 2004. His book, Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World, is just out in paperback. Coming up, critic at large John Powers looks at the summer blockbusters War of the Worlds and Batman Begins. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Batman Begins and War of the Worlds are two hit summer movies that are reworkings of old material. Critic at large John Power says only one film seems to capture the mood of our time.
As last week's bombings in London reminded us, we live in an era officially defined by the War on Terror. Naturally, all this seeps into our popular culture, where two current blockbusters, Batman Begins and The War of the Worlds, have clearly been touched by America's current obsession with terrorism. By now, everybody knows the story of Batman Begins. Christian Bale plays Bruce Wayne, whose parents were murdered when he was a boy. Driven by rage and the desire for revenge, he transforms himself into Batman, a crime fighter who's also something of a creature. To defeat evil, he must tap into his own dark ruthlessness, even if this means Batman isn't really likable. Now, such an idea should carry a timely sting in this age of terrorism, with all the tricky moral questions raised by Abu Ghraib, the Patriot Act, and preemptive war. Especially since the film's villain is an apocalyptic terrorist who wants to destroy Gotham City in order to purify it. But given all this topical subject matter, the movie is strikingly old-fashioned. The Batman saga was created during World War II, and it still has the reassuring vibe found in old comic books and Star Wars movies. It's a franchise. Curiously enough, what may be most old-fashioned about the new Batman is its idealism. Batman believes in both action and community, as he explains to his loyal butler Alfred, marvelously played by Michael Caine.
Are you coming back to Gotham for long, sir?
As long as it takes. I'm going to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city.
Did it?
In a way, their murder shocked the wealthy and the powerful into action.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
If Batman dreams of shaking his fellow citizens out of their apathy, the hero of Steven Spielberg's The War of the Worlds just wants to stay alive. Tom Cruise stars as Ray Ferrier, an irresponsible divorced father who's been given his kids for the weekend. But just after they arrive, monstrous alien war machines rise from the concrete and start pulverizing everything and everyone. So Ray takes his kids and heads for the hills. Ever since H.G. Wells wrote his original novel in 1898, the War of the Worlds story has been a repository for cultural anxieties. While Wells' book reflected that era's worries about run-amok technology and threats to the British Empire, Orson Welles' famous panic-inducing radio broadcast offered a foretaste of World War II. Spielberg's new version clearly taps into our fears of terrorism. After the Space Invaders hit, we even see people carrying around posters of missing loved ones. The single most striking thing about the War of the Worlds is that a Tom Cruise hero makes no attempt to fight back. He leaves that to the military, who we see in the background fighting and dying. In fact, the only civilian who does try to fight is a clammy survivalist played by Tim Robbins. Faced with an enemy too mysterious and powerful to challenge, Ray's only goal is to protect his own family. He seems to believe that old line from the movie Mars Attacks, "Puny humans, resistance is futile." Then again, the movie's real theme isn't battling terror, it's watching it. From the opening scenes of Ray's aghast gaze as the invaders destroy his neighborhood, to the moments when Ray covers his daughter's eyes, to Ray's son abandoning his family with the words, "I want to see it," Spielberg's film is obsessed with the voyeurism of horror, the overpowering desire to look at the spectacle of destruction rather than battle it. This is a voyeurism the movie audience shares. We enjoy the big-budget mayhem in the safety of an air-conditioned theater. Eerily enough, it's this very aura of passivity that makes The War of the Worlds feel so true. It captures a quintessential modern experience. We watch endless televised images of terrorist destruction, but ourselves do nothing to fight it. We watch images of our soldiers in Iraq, yet it feels as if there's nothing we can do. Like the space invaders, history is just too big and powerful. In his famous 1940 essay, Inside the Whale, George Orwell wrote that post-World War I Europe had become so overwhelming that it led to the increasing helplessness of all decent people. Rather than trying to change their world, they found it unchangeable, and therefore sought some sort of refuge in the private realm. Precisely that same attitude runs through the War of the Worlds, which is very much a document of our time. After 2 hours of flamboyant death and destruction, the film winds up like so much of Spielberg's work, with the preservation of a family. Talk about seeking refuge in the private realm. Sure, a billion people were slaughtered by those evil Martians, but Ray learned to be a good father. Now that's a happy ending.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and author of Sore Winners, now available in paperback. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Warner Home Video, presenting Billion Dollar Baby, starring Clint Eastwood and Hilary Swank. Available on DVD July 12th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, invitations are for losers. Vince Vaughn shows up uninvited, then tries to score in the new film Wedding Crashers. We'll hear from Vaughn, and our film critic David Edelstein has a review of the film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the new film Wedding Crashers, Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson play a pair of divorce mediators who've refined the ploy of picking up single women by showing up uninvited at the weddings of complete strangers. Fresh Air's film critic David Edelstein has called the film one of the most delightful comedies in a long time. We'll hear his review of Wedding Crashers a little later. But first, a conversation Terry recorded with Vince Vaughn in 2001. Vaughn has appeared in the films Clay Pigeons, Dodgeball, Anchorman, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, among many others. He made his movie breakthrough in the independent film comedy Swingers, starring his friend Jon Favreau, who also wrote and directed the film. Vaughn and Favreau paired up again in the film Made. Favreau played an amateur boxer who needs money. He hooks up with his do-nothing friend, played by Vaughn, working for a mob boss in L.A. The job brings both of them into the unfamiliar world of money and guns. Favreau knows they're in over their heads, but Vaughn thinks he's cool enough to fake it, which of course keeps getting them deeper into trouble. Here they are on the way to their mission, flying first class for the first time. The flight attendant has just told Vaughn he can choose from a selection of videos.
What's the overhead on stuff like that? What's the action that's going to come my way for the videos?
The action that's going to come your way?
Yeah. What's it going to cost me for the videos?
No, you're up front. Everything's free up here.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. See that?
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. See now?
They set you up and make it like everything's free when they drop this on you. And I bet there's a hidden tax with this. Excuse me, sweetie.
Yes, excuse me.
Where the drinks are concerned, is that a hidden tax? Does that fall under the complimentary upfront service as well, or is that something you pay for?
No, they're complimentary. Would you care for another one?
They're complimentary?
Yes.
You bet your ass I would. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you. Can I get a Cutty on the Rocks, too? Something a little stronger? Is that complimentary?
Yes. Thank yes.
You. Cheers, man. You hear that? Everything up here is free.
Okay.
A scene from the film Made. Terry asked Vince Vaughn to talk about it.
When John and I did Swingers, that was actually the very first time that I ever flew first class, going from Los Angeles to Venice for the film festival. And so when I was on first class, I was a bit overwhelmed by it. And I remember John being uncomfortable because I rang the bell and I asked some questions. But of course, you know, I didn't hit on the stewardess or flight attendant during that time.
What questions did you ask?
I was just like, are you this for free? And I said, you know, so if I want like, you know, a glass of champagne, that's free and I could get more glasses of champagne. She was like, yeah. I was like, are you serious? You know, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, now not only is there like one movie I can choose from, but you're saying that there's like a list of videos and I choose the video that I put in. I can watch any video that I want to watch. And I was just amazed that that was happening. And Faz was kind of embarrassed, like, you know, act like you've been here before. And my point of view was, I haven't been here before. Why should I cheat myself out of this first time experience, you know? So then as we took it, you know, Made in the movie with the mob, but Made as far as being an actor having an avenue in, we exaggerated it then for the comedy and also for who the characters were and what they had to serve for the overall story of the plot.
There's also first times in New York and a swank New York hotel. Did you have any of those first time experiences yourself where you maybe said something inappropriate or acted too overwhelmed by the riches?
Yeah, the biggest one. The biggest one that sticks out was, I remember that, so we do Jurassic Park, which was like, I went from like Swingers and did this other little film called The Locust, and I go to, which was a very small budget as well, to The Lost World, and I was just amazed by the toys and the amount of people that they had and the time that they had to shoot, and when that was over with, there's a thing called Toy Fair, which I'm familiar with because my dad is actually a toy salesman, but they made toys and stuff for Jurassic 3, and so now you go to Toy Fair, and they're sort of selling the toys to the buyers, which would be like Toys R Us or any of those franchises. And so they asked the actors to come, and like we had to come out like with lights and stuff like that and be a part of it and like meet the people and stuff. It was a very odd experience. And they said, you have $150 or I think in incidentals, which means that, you know, the mini bar and, you know, the telephones included in that in this case and room service and that kind of stuff. So I thought it was like $150 for the 3 days I was there, so I was budgeting. And then I realized afterwards, because Jeff Goldblum was there, that it was actually $150 every night I could have spent in the room. But I was like budgeting and thinking that $150 had to go over the whole time. And I was just amazed by that number figure to be spent in a day on sort of pleasantries, you know.
Well, something similar happens to your character in Made. He's told by Peter Falk, who's like the mob guy who's assigning them a job, he's told that they have a daily stipend, and your character thinks, oh, and what is that?
Right, the per diem.
The per diem, yeah.
First time I heard that was on Location, hired as an actor, and they said you have I didn't know what the word per diem meant at all, and they said this is your per diem. I just thought, like, boy, am I getting over on these guys. They're giving me some cash money up front, you know.
You and Jon Favreau also start together in Swingers, which, like Made, he wrote and directed. And in Swingers, you played somebody who was very naive and is reluctantly led into Vegas by you. Because he's broken up with his girlfriend, and you think Vegas is just what he needs.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're really arrogant and really faking it with a lot of flair in this movie. Let me play a short scene. In this scene, this is your first time at one of the casinos with Jon Favreau's character, and you're demonstrating to him how to pick up a cocktail waitress at the casino.
Right.
I walked around for an hour with that stupid scotch on my track.
Yeah, you got knocked out pretty fast.
Oh, a couple of high rollers like yourself.
Can you believe it?
I'll go get you that scotch.
You know, forget about it. I didn't even want it. I just wanted to order it.
Well, can I get you something else? I mean, you really shouldn't leave here without getting something for free.
Why ruin a perfect night? Listen, bring a single malted Glengarry for me and one for my boy Mikey here. And if you tell the bartender to go easy on the water, then this 50-cent piece has your name written all over it, okay? I want you to run along because I'll be timing you. I'm going to keep time. One, two, three, four. What an a**. Baby, that was money. Tell me that wasn't money.
That was so demeaning.
She smiled, baby.
I can't believe what an a**. You are.
No, baby, she smiled.
She was smiling like what an a**.
No. She was smiling at how money I was. What I did with her.
Could we get out of here all right? Because I'm not going to pay for a room.
Mike, what the hell do you want to get out of here for? The honey baby's bringing us a cocktail.
What are you, nuts? You think she's coming back here?
Baby, I know she's coming back here. Did you even hear what she said? You shouldn't leave without getting something for free. Baby, she wants the party. She wants to.
Vince Vaughn, in this scene, we heard one of the catchphrases that you became well known for after Swingers, which was, "You're so money," or "That was so money." That's a phrase that you came up with for the film?
Sort of. I mean, it's sort of a Frankenstein, that phrase, because money existed in sort of a sports culture or hip-hop culture, but sort of going, "You're so money," and or "You're so money, you don't even know it." It was sort of the phrase that caught on, which was the "you don't even know it" and "you're so" is sort of what I added to it. And I used to say that a lot, half-jokingly, with John when we were friends. And, you know, Swingers was based on a real-life experience in that he did break up with his girlfriend in order to move out after he filmed Rudy to pursue acting. And he was really kind of, you know, in a bad way about it. And I sort of, you know, took him out. And the places that I took him was the Dresden and the Derby. And I was sort of into swing music in that lounge scene. And of course, you know, John exaggerated for comedy's sake. We always look at comedy sort of an overcommitment to the ridiculous. So the fact that, you know, Trent would say this and believe it so much and sort of spin it as if this was the ultimate truth and you had to get this down is, to me, kind of pathetic. I was always sort of surprised that Trent was perceived as cool.
Were there people who thought that your character was so cool in the movie they tried to emulate you?
I've heard that, yeah. I've had people come up and say, "Well, boy, I'm the Trent in my group," or this. I just thought, always thought it was funny because I always just thought, like, you know, these guys, I mean, you look at the movie, we're like playing video games, you know? It's not like, the only girl I think Trent ever goes home with is the waitress, and it doesn't really work out with him. They go in the back and knock some stuffed animals off the couch, and that's about it. And then it gets interrupted, you know? But I think that Trent had a real innocence to him. You know, he's not maniacal or manipulative, but not from a complete understanding of what he's doing. I think he's very innocent. I think a lot of men, young men at that age, it's just sort of the thing of, it's such a big deal in a way. I think it shows women is very powerful because all this time and all this attention is spent on sort of how do we communicate with the opposite sex. So in a way, I think it really shows the power that women have, especially where men are concerned, because their whole lives are sort of dictated around, you know, how to connect or talk or communicate with women.
Swingers was really the movie in which you were noticed. What was your life like when you were working on Swingers with Jon Favreau?
Well, it was, you know, very much in the moment at the time, meaning there was no plan of anything. You know, we did the movie for $250,000 in like 21 days, so it was completely off the radar. And part of the reason we were able to do it so cheaply is a lot of it was illegal. We didn't get all the permits and things that you'd need if you were a larger movie that was being tracked or on the radar. A lot of the places that we shot at did us favors because we knew the owners and they let us shoot there for free. And it actually, you know, gave the movie a great feel that it felt very authentic, that these were the people that would be at those places, and it brought a real energy that worked for the movie. But it came from a place of economics, of that was the only way we could get the movie done, and in a way that really served it and made the movie better. And making of Swingers, honestly, Terry, I was just looking to get tape to get an agent. I didn't have an agent at the time. I mean, I didn't know what would come of the thing. You know, we were putting this thing together, and we had read the screenplay for a year, trying to get it set up so it was like a play. We were able to go and shoot and get it, make our days very quickly because we all knew our stuff very well. But, you know, there was always a hope or a dream that it could get bought or that it could be seen, but the odds were just so against it. And we were lucky in that we did what we wanted to do and what we thought we found funny and sort of truthful what our life experience was. You know, we didn't portray in that movie ourselves out to be, you know, street guys or, you know, really overly successful with girls or dealing with heavy problems of drugs and stuff like that, because that wasn't our experience. We were really out-of-work actors playing video games who liked girls and were sort of trying to figure out what was the best way to meet girls. And I think by being simple and telling the story, not having things go good in Vegas, I think it became something that was somewhat universal and a lot of people could relate to.
Vince Vaughn speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2001 interview with actor Vince Vaughn.
I want to ask you about another role that you played, and this was in the movie Clay Pigeons. Mm-hmm. This is one of two movies that you start in with Joaquin Phoenix. And in this film, mm-hmm. you play a cowboy who's very glib, who it turns out he's a con artist and not to mention a serial killer. mm-hmm. How did you envision the part?
Well, I saw it as to make it not so serious and have it be sort of funny and not take it so serious so that it could come off like a bad HBO movie. And I was fascinated by the response to Trent to some degree, and I thought, well, can you play someone who's killing people in a way that has all these what's considered to be pleasant social graces and still have him be liked by people, give him a point of view and some sort of, you know, really messed up code that somehow he followed, and go on that journey with sort of this guy who, how he perceived himself and all these sort of things. And I guess I've always been more drawn and fascinated to those kind of characters because I find it more interesting. And also it's sort of my life experiences are people that I knew. I mean, I would go to the racetrack as a little kid. My dad would take me all the time. And a lot of the people that I met were colorful people, interesting people. And a lot of them, you know, good people, but hustlers, you know. But with my dad being a salesman and sort of the people that I met, I was always really just sort of fascinated by that mindset.
Well, in this scene from Clay Pigeons, you're at a bar, you've just walked in, and you're trying to pick up a character played by Janine Garofalo. And there are, as you mentioned, kind of traces of your character, Trent from Swingers, in your approach here. Let's hear it.
Damn! Good looking girl. Drinks Johnny Walker Black. Even pays with her own money. I can't wait to start dreaming nice.
You're very colorful.
Oh, you don't know the half of it. I'm like a big fireworks show. But very bright. Like light bright.
You know what? No offense, but this seat is saved.
Who for?
First guy not wearing denim.
You're not from around here, are you?
What makes you say that?
Well, you don't look like the town much. You don't. My name's Lloyd. I won't bite you.
That's a plus, Lloyd.
That's a scene from Clay Pigeons. Vince Vaughn, do you want to say anything about that scene?
Just that, you know, that was my favorite scenes in the movie was with Janine Garofalo. I think she's incredible. And some of that was improvised, and she's just so great and so available. It was really very easy to respond off of her. I mean, I knew I had the burden of Janine, who's a very bright, sophisticated person, although she's playing this character and she knows ultimately that she has to give in to me because that's, you know, the script and sort of where we need to take it for the movie. So she's open to that. So my job's a little easier, but I knew it had to come off believable that you bought that I made her laugh or that I got her to be open to talking to me. And so, you know, I went in there with a real specific point of view and really the biggest thing with those kind of things are listening and really paying attention to her movement and her talking and seeing what, you know, what was the way in, what was the way into this particular person.
You grew up in Minnesota. Would you describe the neighborhood that you were from?
Well, I didn't really grow up in Minnesota. I was born outside of Minneapolis.
You grew up in Chicago, right.
I lived there for about a month. My dad was a salesman for Swift Meat Company, and he was transferred. I lived in Minnesota for 1 month, and I was raised in Buffalo Grove, which is sort of a middle-class suburb in Illinois. And I lived there till I was 8, and then I moved to Lake Forest, Illinois, which is an upper-class suburb of Illinois. And I lived there until I was 18 and graduated.
Were your parents moving up financially when you moved up to a better
neighborhood? My dad was. Yeah, my dad was. My dad was a very driven man in that, you know, he grew up not very well off or well-to-do and, you know, sort of self-motivated and put himself through college, used to work in a factory in the summer to, you know, pay for college and that got a job right away working sales for Swift's Meats and then got transferred and around and moved up and did very well. And then he became, and then moved, switched over to the toy industry. So then he opened up his own company when we moved to Lake Forest. And it was a big deal, I think, for my mom and that who grew up sort of blue collar as well, to sort of give us kids a better education opportunity than what they had. A big part of the reason for us moving there was because of the schools and the academics, which is sort of funny. I became an actor and I never went to college.
Now, I read that you were in a class with problem kids. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, well, the thing, as time has gone on, people have learned more, but I went into a class one period a day. They would make me go to a classroom with, you know, maybe 10 or 12 other students, all who had no obvious retardation or anything, but it was more learning disabilities. Mm. But for me, it was like, you know, and I sort of felt like McMurphy in Cuckoo's Nest, and I've said that before, and that you'd have the tallest girl in the whole school. She would never talk. She'd never raise her hand in class. But, you know, you sort of look at that and say, well, this girl's already sticking out in a sort of way. Maybe she doesn't feel like raising her hand, you know. And I think most of the people there had more to do with sort of an emotional position based on a physical thing. Chuck Suitmeyer was in the thing, and his parents were still farmers, and he dressed differently than everybody else. So that probably had more to do with it than anything else. But we would go, and it was embarrassing because you'd be 10 years old, and you'd go for one period a day, and they'd make you play Candyland. And everyone in the school knew you were going to this classroom. So as you're struggling to have a social life, that was definitely something that was a hindrance. But it was really a gift for me. I mean, in a way, it made me be, I think, more outspoken and that sort of thing in order to have friends. And I was always very popular and well-liked, not just by one group, but I think by most of the kids in my school growing up. And I felt a need to sort of counter that by, I think, being funny and having a sense of humor and maybe being a bit confrontational with teachers and that sort of thing. And when I first went into the class, I was very kind of mean to the other kids, and I felt like, I don't belong here. These kids are crazy. I don't belong here with these kids. And then that kind of grew into me feeling very connected to them and very protective of them and, you know, going out of my way to try to include them and, you know, whether we were playing kickball at recess or whatever, I would go and, you know, pick them for my team, and I felt very including of them after a while.
What was your learning disability?
I don't know. I don't know what it was. I think I just had a short attention span, and I think everyone learns differently. I mean, I was in all normal classes. It was just that, you know, certain kids who they felt like needed one class a day to go, but it's not like the class was effective. There was nothing that was done there. It was just a place to put these kids. You know, and all the other people that were in the class were all fine and very capable people. And I think probably had more to do with a family home experience or a physical thing in school or maybe, you know, a dyslexia that was, you know, better understood now today than it was in the early 70s. Sort of the thing to do then was sort of throw Ritalin at it, you know.
Yeah, were you ever treated with Ritalin?
They said that they wanted to put me on Ritalin. My mom gave it to me one time. And I reacted badly to it. And then both my parents, my dad, said, you know, there's no way my son's going to go through life doped up. There's just, you know, how can he process or learn anything or mature or grow if doesn't have his senses about him, you know? He's not going to be able to process things. I was lucky that my parents were, you know, had that sort of vision. A lot of parents went through it, I think, with their kids. But, you know, when the school's telling you it's the right thing and it's helping them, it's hard to say that they did bad. But my parents, I was fortunate enough, knew that that wasn't the right thing.
Vince Vaughn speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. He's starring with Owen Wilson in the new movie Wedding Crashers. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the film. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn star in the new comedy Wedding Crashers. It's about two single divorce mediators with a unique strategy for meeting women. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
When I saw the poster for Wedding Crashers, I groaned. Because lately, I've been thinking that Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn are Johnny One-Notes, whose shtick is getting old. You've got Wilson, the adorably diffident, semi-stone surfer dude, made a little more vulnerable by a nose that goes in like six different directions, and Vaughn, the really tall, sleazy, jabbering wild man. We get it already. Plus, one or both seem to show up in a movie every month. But the preview for Wedding Crashers was a hoot, and the director, David Dobkin, made a half-successful black comedy in 1998 called Clay Pigeons, in which Vaughn was great as a serial killer whose bland bonhomie grew creepier with each new corpse. I'm glad I didn't blow the movie off, because I'd have missed one of the most delightful comedies in a long time. No, it's not Preston Sturgis, the center is mushy, and it's totally formulaic. But the script by Steve Faber and Bob Fisher is one of those high-speed ping-pong banter marvels in which you're still laughing from the last great line when you're hit by another and another. And say what you will about Wilson and Vaughn, they have crackerjack timing. Vaughn is like the machine that shoots tennis balls, thunk, 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 while Wilson lulls you with his lazy rhythms, and then when your guard is down, nails you with the joke. You get an inkling in this early exchange, which sets up the premise. Here are two guys, John and Jeremy, who work as mediators in divorce cases and have a suitably jaded view of long-term relationships and marriage. Their seasonal hobby is showing up at weddings and seducing marriage-minded females. And now they're mapping out the next few strenuous weeks.
It's wedding season, kid!
You sandbagging son of a...
I got us down for 17 of them already.
Okay, now how many of them are cash bars?
Great question. Love where your head's at. And two of them actually are. But I got us covered. Purple Hearts. We won't have to pay for a drink all night.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
We are going to have tons and tons of opportunities to meet gorgeous ladies that are so aroused by the thought of marriage that they'll throw their inhibitions to the wind.
And who's going to be there to catch them?
Grab that net and catch that beautiful butterfly, pal.
I wish that excerpt had gone on longer. See, we have to use what the studio gives us, because it's amazing the way the writers sustain that pitch. The first act is nonstop conquests. John and Jeremy show up at weddings where nobody knows them, but they don't keep a low profile. They dance with the bride and her family. They entertain the kids under the admiring eyes of their female prey. They make toasts. It climaxes in a dizzying montage of surrendering women that's intercut with the pair as they dance to Shout, a little bit softer now, a little bit louder now. It builds and builds and then explodes. This is all pretty sexist, but given the moralistic climate of the moment, it's exhilarating to see a genuinely R-rated comedy with dirty talk and casual sex. Wedding Crashers has incensed some conservative commentators because Senator John McCain, a one-time critic of filthy Hollywood values, shows up in a cameo. But the joke's on them because the values are still rather traditional. After their series of triumphs, Wilson's John sits depleted on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, with a tall, straight Washington Monument in the distance practically mocking him, and asks, "Is that all there is?" These feckless studs will have to get their comeuppance and let true love pitch a tent in their hearts. This happens when they crash the so-called Kentucky Derby of weddings, the daughter of the Treasury Secretary, played by Christopher Walken. Would you let him handle your money? John is instantly smitten by the bride's sister, played by Rachel McAdams, and she's too ravishing and unaffected, not to mention smart, to seduce and abandon. So John breaks all the rules of wedding crashing and prevails upon Jeremy to go to the family's country house. Jeremy fights him, because he's already made it with a third daughter, played by Isla Fisher, whom he thinks is a little clingy. He calls her a stage five clinger. In the film's second half, the conflict is between these increasingly helpless con artists and an extended family of ruthless blue bloods, indefatigable sailors, quail hunters, and bone-crunching touch football players. Director Dobkin and the writers keep everything in riotous motion, at least until the last 20 minutes, when the film turns sappy and conventional. But it's a mark of a good seducer that you recognize the hustle but go along anyway, because resisting, that would be a drag. Wedding Crashers gives you a great shallow romp without making you feel bad in the morning.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate.
I feel alright.
Yeah.
Now that I got my woman, I feel alright. So good to me, you know you make me wanna flip.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts at pewtrusts.org, advancing policy solutions to preserve the oceans. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with comedian and actor John Leguizamo. He's starring in a new Spanish-language film called Crónicas, about a TV tabloid reporter from Miami who travels to Ecuador to track down a serial killer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.